My name is Ann Palmerton, and I serve as an associate pastor at a Presbyterian church, Broad Street Presbyterian Church in Columbus, Ohio.
And I'm Robin Henry, and I serve as a director of music and liturgy at a Roman Catholic parish in Minneapolis, St. Albert the Great.
My name is Kathleen Olson, and I work at St. Martin's Table, a restaurant and bookstore that's a peace education center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And the title of this session is Reimagining the Continuing Conversation. So welcome.
We'll sing this together so you can get an essence of how it goes, and then we'll divide into two parts and sing it in a two-part round. It's actually four parts, but we'll just try two tonight.
Okay. And I'll lead the first side when we get to that.
Gathered here in the mystery of this hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near.
Please join us.
Gathered here in the mystery of this hour.
How many of you are here and did not attend the session last night? A few, okay. So word got out about this conference and our conversation. We'd like to start tonight off by doing a little bit of a recap and by acknowledging that we received from you at least two direct questions at the end of last night's session. The first question had to do with the goals of the ecumenical decade, Churches in Solidarity with Women. And so we thought we'd spend some time going over those goals and making sure that we articulated them in a way that communicates. And the second question had to do with my own denomination, the Presbyterians, and a question about what it was that maybe prepared us or got us to the point as a denomination where an event like the Reimagining Conference was able to bring us to a crisis. So I don't even assume to carry all that knowledge within my own person, but there are some other Presbyterians here tonight, and maybe we can put our heads together a little bit and have some conversation about that. But I don't want that to take up the rest of the time. We wanted also to get to the conference and to your questions and to conversation. So that's kind of the flow of our time together. Should I jump in with the decade?
Sure.
I had quickly described last night that the conference grew out of a declaration by the World Council of Churches in 1987 that declared a decade, an ecumenical decade, Churches in Solidarity with Women. That's real key. It wasn't women in solidarity with women. It was churches to stand together with women across the globe. And that was to take, was to be a decade, obviously, that lasts 10 years. And in the midst of that, the Reimagining Conference would begin. Okay, I described some of the goals, and they sound enormous and not rooted in necessarily anything. Empowering women to challenge oppressive structures in the global community, in their country, and in their church. Affirming in shared leadership and decision-making, theology and spirituality, the contributions women are already making in churches and communities. The third was giving visibility to women's perspectives and actions in the struggle for justice, peace, and the integrity of creation. The fourth was to enable churches, this is huge, to free themselves from racism, sexism, and classism, and from teachings and practices that discriminate against women. These are broad brushstrokes, encouraging churches to take actions in solidarity with women. The concept for this ecumenical decade flowed from a previous decade that had been the United Nations Decade for Women. And some of you may have been involved in that at some level, that stretched from 1975 to 1985. See, then this was to continue from 88 to 98. Goals in the United Nations decade included some specific things. Focusing on local and multinational industries that often exploit the vulnerability of women who work at the lowest paid jobs without protection or security. Focusing on the fact that women are often the first to lose their jobs in time of economic difficulty. Highlighting the fact that in rural areas, women receive the least attention in development plans and are not consulted about their basic needs. Fourth, among those who suffer most from nuclear testing are women who bear the burden of increased miscarriage. Fifth, women who are victims of racism are often subjected to double or triple oppression, not only as members of a race that is discriminated against, but also as poor people and as women. Famine and war strike women hardest because they carry the heaviest responsibility for their families. Worsening social and economic conditions raise frustration among men. The rate of sexual abuse and violence against women increases. And finally, growing poverty and sex tourism are drawing more and more ever younger women into prostitution. Okay, you're familiar with a lot of these issues, and the goal of the decade was to somehow incarnate, I think I could say, care about this, ownership of this, focus on these issues. And the response that the World Council of Churches has seen in North America, at least, has focused all of these things into four major areas. Okay, we're focusing now. And those are women's full and creative participation in the life of the church, violence against women in its various forms and dimensions, the global economic crisis and its effect on women, and racism and xenophobia and its effect on women. Okay. Now, how do you bring those global concerns down to a local level? Well, one of the ideas is study this book in a group. The other is connect with your church, the headquarters of your own church body, and ask about what's happening regarding this decade in your own community. Assess your own neighborhood and your own city, and which of those four that I read last would be most relevant in your city to focus on. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done. You want to chime in at that point, or?
That's
about it. Okay. We hope that gets at something of that general but important question regarding the decade itself. Okay. Regarding the question of Presbyterians, friends, there, I would say that since the turn of the century, the Presbyterian Church has been struggling with what, at least where I was trained at Princeton Seminary, was called old school, new school issues that have to do with interpretation of the Bible, and a lot of of theology that comes out of that. And so we, as a denomination, we've been having this conversation and this dialogue and this difference for a long time over different issues, but always finding that we were having a hard time talking to one another. And then it was in 1992 that the Human Sexuality Task Force, which obviously the Lutherans are in the midst of right now, was presented. And that was like dynamite in the life of our denomination. And we don't have a system of bishops, so the people who were attacked were the committee of clergy and lay people who constructed this document. And a number of people were unable to receive calls to new locations as clergy. And so the whole issue has developed of, you know, if you're going to serve on a national task force, you know, what are you putting at risk? I mean, it's a pretty profound thing. So we decided in 1993 to basically encourage our denomination to have conversation and dialogue about sexuality, which at least in Ohio we haven't done. I don't know about the West Coast, whether you all have. We're supposed to be in dialogue for 3 years until next summer when we all get together in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and suddenly we can talk about sexuality again. The problem is that we haven't been talking about it very much in the interim, and I'm going to call on the two Presbyterian folk sitting, three Presbyterian folk, if you'd like to say anything at this point.
Well, the comment I want to make about the report, which, as you say, caused the big explosion, there seemed to be a huge, at least my interpretation is that there seemed to be a huge misunderstanding about that. It had some pretty heavy, strong stuff in it. Stuff, not all of which did I agree with. But I got the idea that people felt that this was set in cement, and that it was set out to be approved of. And my interpretation is that was not the case at all. That it was distributed to churches for congregations to study and look at and make their own comments and suggestions for changes. But people didn't read it that way. Now, is that your read on it also? Yeah, I think that's what caused, and we could never get away from the idea that no, this wasn't the end all. So that's what one of the things
was about. Are you talking about a Presbyterian response to the Lutheran?
No,
we're talking about our own Presbyterian human sexuality statement that it in the Presbyterian denomination was so. Yeah.
And they.
Do you want to say something?
They've asked for dialogue, as you mentioned, for 3 years, and next year we're supposed to, as a church, as our individual church, to respond. Now our church has taken some action, we've taken some dialogue, but as you said, in Iowa,
Ohio,
there's not much going on.
Yeah.
There's not much going on in certain churches in California either. And here you have a chance to have dialogue, which we always say, only have dialogue about an issue. And then you get people together and there's no dialogue, or you're speaking to the choir, those that already have an understanding or an opinion. So without that, I'll turn it over to Gordon. You're welcome.
Yeah, do you want to add anything?
I guess so.
Gordon serves I should introduce you, as he serves as a moderator of a presbytery in the San Francisco.
Yes, I'm currently moderator of the San Francisco Presbytery. It's not a real big deal. It's a one-year thing. I would say that, you know, we've been going through this whole human sexuality thing for a long time, and I'm sure that our denomination isn't any different than any others with respect to how one sees that in light of biblical interpretation and societal change. At the end of the 1993 General Assembly, we were asked to study this for a period of 3 years. As Dave just points out, he didn't point out, but the fact is that in the numbers, if they were to take a vote whether to adapt the report on human sexuality, which is to be open and affirming of all forms of committed relationships, it would fail, simply because that's where the numbers are. And the Layman magazine is probably the big organizing group of those that would be in the forefront, and with a lot of dollars,
right,
to support that. The other thing that I think brought this reimagining conference to the point that it could create such a controversy within our denomination is the Reverend Janie Spahr.
Okay.
Janie was there. It was well publicized that she was going to be there. Janie is an out lesbian Presbyterian clergy person who was ordained prior to the time that was permitted. She was called to the, as most of you already know, she was called to the Downtown Presbyterian Church in Rochester, New York, and our permanent judicial commission ruled that she could not accept that call. She's currently employed as an evangelist on staff, and that position is being held open for the time that she might be able to accept that call. But it was basically, I think the big controversy over reimagining was the fact that here was the Doris Williams statement and others that the layman and people like that would say, I told you so. You know, if you're going to let those women in there, that's the sort of thing that's going to happen. You know, it's going to be primarily a lesbian thing. And that's only just a very, very small part of it. And it split every denomination. It split every presbytery in our denomination. And my guess is that it split most of the denominations. And if it hasn't, yours it will. And if it hasn't, it's because you're not talking about it. And because that's what happens with ours. We don't talk about it. We don't have to. You know, the people who want to talk, the people who are willing to talk about it are the people who really don't need to.
Yeah,
and the people who don't want to talk about it don't have to because they have the votes. They also have the dollars. So it's, you know, it's really a struggle. There, our last year's moderator of our denomination has likened the what's happening in the Presbyterian Church in the Christian Church with a big C to the Reformation in 1525. It's that bigger. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to recognize that and deal with it on that basis.
I think the statistic is that the Presbyterian Lay Committee, there have been attempts at the Presbyterian national level to reconcile 13 times. And just this last year alone, $35,000 was spent in an attempt to do this reconciliation, to have this dialogue, and the dialogue kept breaking down, and reconciliation was really not achieved with this group, and so the kind of the jury is still out on what's happening with all of us.
Just one more thing, and then I'll shut up. But you know, during this 3-year period of dialogue, where we were asked to discuss and study this issue, there was and currently is no way for there to be honest and open dialogue, because so many of the people who would be part of the dialogue are at risk. You know, if they come out with who they are, they're at risk of losing their ordination.
Yeah. I just want to say you're not alone in that. I think within every denomination that's struggling with that issue, there are clergy persons and lay persons alike who are terrified to come out, whether they're just coming out in support of sexuality issues or coming out as gay or lesbian.
Yeah,
themselves,
so well, it's both ways,
yeah,
with us too.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're not thinking much will be resolved in this. We're just having a conversation tonight. I wanted to say that in terms of the conference, I wanted to remind us of something that came up in conversation after last night, which was the point of the Reimagining Conference was not to create a system of doctrine. Okay? That was not the point. People were not coming together to write things down and come out with some kind of cohesive new doctrine for the Christian church. Rather, it really was a global colloquium in which women from all over the globe came together to share their story and to talk about how they were doing theology in their particular context.
The Reimagining Conference, though, was a Presbyterian initiative.
No, World Council of
Churches.
It
was not. It was a World Council of Churches initiative. So it was ecumenical to the core. In other words,
and the money behind it was World Council money or Presbyterian money?
The $66,000 in seed money that undergirded all of that travel that needed to take place was Presbyterian money. And that's what got our denomination in the thick of it. However, there were contributions from all the major denominations.
And it was intended as a World Council, National Council of Churches.
World Council.
World Council of Churches Conference.
Conference, yeah. So no one denominational theology was...
was at the forefront.
Was at the forefront.
It was many doctrines and many theologies, basically. Mm-hmm. If it's ecumenical, mm-hmm. then it has to be. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. Because in trying to, it's so hard to say every time, the Ecumenical Decade Churches in Solidarity with Women. I mean, this enormous, unwieldy
title. I think it was a Presbyterian response to that World Council theme, but it's not.
It's not.
It's the World Council, itself.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. There was no one there saying, this is what you will now believe. This is a new doctrine you will swallow. You can't leave unless you make a new kind of faith statement. There was no kind of pressure or anything like that. I want to make sure you have a sense that this was a discovery, and really a reimagining is a wonderful title. I read Sally Hill's article in which she talked about how the name of the conference came to be. And the planners were brainstorming names for this conference, and someone had brainstormed the word reimagining. And then the woman who was writing it on the board spelled it wrong and spelled reimagining. And they started playing with the difference between reimagining and reimagining. And they chose reimagining because religious imagination is at the core of what was happening.
Same thing. The other thing about these people from all over the globe, you know, 37 presenters coming to share their stories, then after a presentation, you had a talking circle. So people at the table had a chance to tell their story for the first time in some of those women and some of those men's entire lives, to share their story. You know, I'm a closet Roman Catholic. I don't tell anyone I am. You know, that kind of stuff. Painful things about themselves because they heard for the first time other women who had oppressive situations in Africa and Korea and places that they only read about but had never been, but we're on our soil now.
Okay. So it was an attempt to have conversation around the variety of critical issues to women on a global scale.
Right, and critical theological issues.
Yeah.
God, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit, church, salvation.
But not only theological issues.
Right.
You heard the emphasis on peace and justice, violence, etc. A lot of those were at issue also.
All of which could be considered theological issues.
I think
actually there were no non-theological issues.
Thank you.
Can I put some historical perspective on this? Because I've been thinking about the Reimagining Conference and the backlash. It seems to me it was an idea that was the right thing to do. It was biblical. It was good for the spirituality of the people that was there. It was a progressive idea that met a traditionalist backlash, which goes through history. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement is a good example. It was the right thing to do, but the white clergy in Birmingham said, don't do it, we're not ready for it yet. And Martin Luther King said, we've been saying that for 500 years, we're tired of saying the public is not ready for what is the right thing to do. And he had a horrible conservative backlash to that progressive movement. This is just another example. Jesus did the same thing. He had a progressive movement, had a horrible backlash. This is just a historical thing. We should have predicted it. We could have predicted it.
Thank you. Walt?
I couldn't disagree more. I want to say some things about the dreadful dilemmas that are confronting people who 30 years ago could link arms and hands in a variety of causes. And what has happened is that we have discovered that the causes to which we are committed are incompatible with each other. That's part of the problem. And it has to be said flat out. I marched in 1965 on behalf of civil rights for blacks in this country. And I am deeply committed to the role of women in equality in the church. And the two are now incompatible, because black religion is sexist to the core. And therefore, I cannot be both committed to the rights of African Americans in this country and Africa and the world, and to the role and rights of women. I sit on the commission of Anglican Lutheran, International Commission. We met in 1992 in South Africa. We met with representatives of all of the countries from Kenya down through Namibia on the eastern edge and southern edge of Africa. And the issue that created the most absolute tension, it was almost unbearable, was the fact that the African women were in direct conflict with the African men who were running the churches and running the country. And so the white Westerners who were there, there were 45 people there, we white Westerners withdrew for 2 days so that the African women and the African men could confront each other. We created a space for this to happen. But it was awful. It was just awful. I've all my life, I've been committed to the ecumenical movement. The ecumenical movement is committed to the proposition to the confession that Jesus Christ is God and Savior, right? The Reimagining Conference appeared to me to challenge that commitment, so that to be committed on the one hand to the ecumenical movement's confession that Jesus is God and Savior was challenged by not by the essays, but by the worship of the Reimagining Conference. So I'm sitting here as a white, male, ecumenical, deeply committed to the reign of God issues that the church has confronted, to peace and justice, and I find myself torn apart by every one of those commitments. Liturgical integrity, Catholic confession, the rights of women, the place of the colonial peoples of the world, the Africans. I mean, I want all of these things at once, and I am discovering that I cannot have them. I cannot be committed to all of them. I am forced to make choices, and it is destructive beyond words. I cannot tell you how destructive this is. I know that there are reactionary forces that capitalize on this, but what you have to hear, what all of you have to hear, is that it is the people committed to the reign of God who are being ripped apart by the alternative commitments which we are being forced to make.
Thank you.
No, you don't want to thank me.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful word.
I still don't get it. Can you say some more?
Yes. I cannot worship Father Mother, for starters. I believe in imaging women in language about God, and I cannot believe that God has revealed himself to us in Jesus as Father Mother. That's part of what tears me apart. I cannot both say yes to the sexism of a Martin Luther King and the affirmation of equality for African Americans and whites. I cannot both say yes to Idi Amin and all of the commitments to justice and peace that I have. I mean, just go down the list of all the things that have happened in the last 20 years, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. I cannot say yes to a God who is to a fertility God, a Baal or an Astarte on the one hand, and to the revelation that has taken place in Jesus as God and Savior on the other.
And you hear this conference calling you to say yes to Astarte, or
if it were only lectures, I know what to do with lectures. I weigh them. I say yes to some and no to others, yes to parts and no to other parts. But when we are called to worship, then we are called to pray, to confess, to acknowledge. And one cannot pray and confess and acknowledge when one is confronted with fertility gods and goddesses. You just can't. That's not reactionary. That's
well,
not
with, I, with all due respect, Walt, with due respect to not having been there and not seeing the texts with which they used for the liturgy, and I know you haven't seen those. Most of us haven't seen those. We heard those. Those of us that were there, people who weren't there, how would they get their hands on them? So I don't think you really know totally what you're saying. I think you're trying to say that you believe that people were worshiping a goddess, which is certainly what the media tried to portray, and that was completely false, that we were clearly opening up the image of God so that it wasn't clearly patriarchal, masculine, the image that most of us grew up with and are tired of. And I'd like to teach my daughters and my son that God is more than Papa, more than Abba, more than Father.
More than Mother.
More than, yes.
Beyond metaphor, beyond belief. I mean, just so awesome that we can't right. put...
We cannot put words to it. Exactly.
Male, one, or.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think another problem, Walt, is you say you cannot say yes to this and yes to this. The way I read, I wasn't at the conference, I learned as much as I can about it, I know what's been talked about in our church. I don't think that anyone is being asked to say yes to something they can't say yes to. They're just being asked to respect someone else's right to say yes to how they
experience
imagine
God.
Their relationship with God. It's all about a relationship to God. I see it widening, not narrowing, and not making divisions. That's just my own read on it.
I'd like to say, well, also that in one of the handouts that I have more copies of is an article by Joseph Small and John Burgess from the Louisville, which is where the Presbyterian headquarters is. And if we zero into their main point, it chimes with your point, which is that lecture is one thing, worship is another. And that continues to be part of the Presbyterian dilemma in dealing with this conference. And obviously you're articulating it too. because worship moves us into a confessional stance from a stance of analysis. And I think the conference creators would say maybe that it's all part and parcel of the same cloth, but traditionally it has not been. And I know that the criticism I've heard at large degree from sympathetic Presbyterians, and I hear you, civil rights, etc., has been along that line. So, I mean, I would say that's something we need to continue to have conversation about. I know for me personally, the experience would have been so different without the worship. Okay, because so for me, I deeply appreciated the worship experience and the introduction to this attribute of God's wisdom through the worshiping experience. I'd like to read a paragraph written by another Presbyterian, Frieda Gardner. Frieda Gardner was taught Christian education at Princeton Seminary for many years and is a woman of wisdom. And following the Reimagining Conference, she wrote a reflection, and I want to read a couple paragraphs, and I try and track with me. I think there's a lot here. What is it about experiences that threaten us? A book, a film, a discussion, a worship service, a behavior, and we tense, we fidget, we look away or tune out or walk out. It is well documented that more of us than not are uncomfortable with conflict and will go to almost any lengths to avoid it. Most of us know that conflict that is not dealt with does not simply go away. It seems to stockpile, making us ever more reluctant to confront it when it does appear next time. New and different experiences do create conflict for many of us, most of the time or all of the time. Low or high level panic sets in, and we choose from our repertoire of learned responses to deal with it. This sense of unease, of defensiveness or hostility must have something to do with vulnerability, with powerlessness. Will I get swept away with an idea, trapped into a way of being or an attitude? Will I find myself in a position or a place where I don't want to be? What do these fears say about our understanding of ourselves and our trust in ourselves? Am I afraid that if I am present to a behavior or an idea or an experience, that I will not only have to acknowledge it, but also begin to make it my own? Do I not trust myself enough to allow another's experience or thought its right to be, knowing that I am in control of my own choices? Parents don't want sex education for their children because they reason if children know about sex, they'll do it. Communism can't be taught as a form of social and political organization because they'll become communists. Were we parents and adults never taught that knowing, feeling, and willing are three different things, and that we can dare to know and to feel because we also can decide if and how we will act on those thoughts and feelings? Nothing in the Ecumenical Decade of Women Conference suggested that we should all come away from it believing, thinking, or acting in the same ways. No one hinted that the way she thought was the only way to think, or that what we did was the only way for us to worship or pray or create pictures or dance and sing. It is, at the least, interesting that Presbyterians of all people should be resisting what was experienced in Minneapolis, because we confess a living God, a God engaged with us, acting in history, and we quote with perhaps too much pride that we are reformed and being reformed. That's like our motto. We speak often of the God we know in Jesus Christ doing a new thing in our midst, but we cannot tolerate when any new thing does not look or sound pretty much like the old things we're comfortable with. We accept the advice that we must test to see if this or that is of God, that we seek together to discern the mind of Christ, but we're often afraid to let anything different be said out loud or to participate in anything new to the extent that we could speak and pray together about its truth. Is it possible that we have made idols of our personal standards of orthodoxy and turned away from the God who has been unorthodox from the beginning? Maybe an ultimate act of faith is to believe that God will be with us in the very things that frighten us the most, and that God's truth will emerge from our risking as much as from our defending what has always been. That's a long way to go about it. It's an amazing point.
The problem is that I take all these arguments seriously.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can get to me with what you're saying. All I want you to know is you're twisting the knife.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, maybe it has to be, you know, I know Frieda.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We've done a conference together.
Yeah.
I'm so set. I just want you to know what this does to all of us who over the years have, in a sense, carried the commitment and borne the burden and done the stuff and believe all of these things. You know. But now we're confronted with painful choices between our commitments. The choice between liturgical renewal and new liturgies. The choice between confessional neo-orthodoxy and all the things that for us were a way to reform the church. Do you understand?
Well, and I would also suggest that it confronts all of us. Mm-hmm. One of the painful things that we were talking about with the conference was when Robin and Kathleen came forward. I should probably tell the whole story. A woman. It's the morning presentation, the plenary presentation. So there are 2,200 people, and we're listening to a woman from Ghana, Mercy Amba Odiwaye. I can't pronounce her last name. She's like the matriarch of feminist theology in Africa. She's probably at the forefront of what you were experiencing painfully. She was she had captured us in her. As she was describing what community is like in Africa, with all the aunts and the uncles and just the extended family, and how community looks different. So when her talk concluded, that's when
Janie must have come forward.
When Janie Spar came forward and spoke into the microphone and said, "This is a time when if women who are gay would like to come forward and come out, and if women who would like to stand in solidarity with them would like to do that, that's what we're going to do right now." Nothing on the schedule for this celebration to happen. It wasn't listed in our program. It just
spontaneous.
It's spontaneous and it happened. So Robin and Kathleen were talking about the power of that in coming forward, and I was saying the power of standing in solidarity and saying, yeah, I have friends in ministry who are struggling with their sexuality. And then there was one woman at our talking circle who sat down and looked enraged, and an African-American woman. And I found out later that for her, this was a tremendous insult, because Mercy, this woman from Africa, should have gotten many rounds of applause, should have gotten standing ovation after standing ovation. She had earned the right to be in the light for this period of time, and this spontaneous celebration, which excited so many, also was a complete insult to the African American community and the people who were there. So all of which is to say that even this community is not all out of the same cloth, that women are not united in some kind of seamless fashion. I hope that communicates that the issues are right there around the table, and we're dealing with racism and the oppression that we do to one another. Did you have a?
I was going to say Sally Hill also concludes at the end of her article, talking about the planners and the people that put this together. A number of women of color were glad to consult with the planning group as significant issues arose, but we were not equal at the table. Our solidarity is not complete. And we white women learned once again that so much of the time we just don't get it. That is a painful learning, reminding us again of our white racism.
And Joan Martin, another Presbyterian who does studies with ethics, really had some hard things to say to the planners and to the plenary about the way that institutional racism was not addressed at the conference. Yeah, you know, that she was right.
Good.
Could I address another question
yes.
to Walt? Walt, are you saying that the civil rights movement, as one example, did not pose the challenges to worship that feminist movement poses? Is that what you're saying?
No, no. Same problem.
Are you saying that the feminist movement is different from the civil rights movement?
No.
You disagreed with this fellow.
No. I'm saying that in the 30 or 40 years since I've been around, the commitments that I once thought could be shared are not shared. And that almost everything I've ever been committed to confronts me now with just gut-wrenching choices, one after another. And I could have used the civil rights movement as an example of not only the conflict between sexism and racism, but the conflicts within me between liturgical renewal. I read Toni Morrison's Beloved and the worship that she describes led by Baby Suggs, and I wanted to say yes and no at the same time, and it just tore me apart again. All I'm saying is, it is too damn easy to say this is a conflict between liberals and reactionaries.
Right, that's
it
right.
It won't
that's
work.
Right. Yeah.
The problem is the dreadful revelation of the conflict that I experience between one set of commitments and another. And it's really across the board. I can't begin to illustrate all the ways in which I am just torn apart. And I've
it's not as if the feminist movement is a new breed of cat.
No. Bad image. I mean, let me just say some things. I introduced at Trinity the course on women in Christian history and theology. I taught it, I team taught it always with a woman. And then I was told by the Women's Caucus that I couldn't teach the course anymore. It was designed by women, always outside the seminary because we didn't have any on the faculty at the time. I was the way in which we could give credit for it, but I didn't preside. I just was the vehicle. And the Women's Caucus went to the board and complained that I was teaching the course, although they didn't know why I had to be teaching it and why the women that I brought in to design the course and to teach it. We had as our goal that every male who takes the course commits himself to preparing his congregation so that the next person they called could be a woman. I'm very aware that how difficult it is for women to be senior pastors, but I couldn't teach the course anymore. It has not been taught since I was not allowed to teach it anymore. I mean, those are the kinds of things, and it isn't the women's movement that does this. It's the inevitable acceleration of the demands by each movement for this and this and this, that finally comes to the point where you have to say, where are my commitments? And I don't know where they are anymore. I want God to judge, and I just want to go. I want to leave the stage. I don't want to go. I don't want to be there anymore. Because the oppositions, the opposing forces are just too darn painful. But you're doing this.
Well,
you're doing this to the liberals in the church. That's what's happening. And everybody is doing it.
Do you want to say something, Sue?
I guess I just want to ask, as I try to hear you, if somehow you think that those who seem to be these others are not in pain or not committed.
No.
Because I feel like somehow you are saying your pain is different or special when for hundreds of years the same, the people that spoke
yes.
have been in pain.
See, that's the point. You can get to me with all of this. But what I don't want is simply to say it's the reactionaries versus the liberals.
That point's well made.
Won't work anymore.
There's a beautiful, beautiful poster up in the bookstore here that to me says it all and released me in a lot of prejudice and negative feelings that I have about things that are happening in my faith and our faith. Jesus and his troublemakers go merrily along. And I think we have to face up to that, that if we're going to be living Christians, keep it simple. Think like a child. Jesus and his troublemakers go merrily along.
Also, the image that perhaps most reveals God's love for us is the image of Jesus on the cross. The sense of suffering love, which tore him apart in essence. And I think he was able to move in that direction because he sensed more and more deeply that the people who needed love in the world the most were the ones that were most torn apart and did not feel any kind of connection with God. And that would have been the worst, the most abject kind of death or kind of abandonment. We know ourselves to be loved by God, and so in a sense, Walt, I think we also know that it is for Jesus that we undertake the kinds of difficult conversations and difficult commitments. I look at people who have gone before me, and I look at the commitments that they've made that make it possible for us to be at a place like this. And some have really been unrecognized, and some have had their mouths stopped. And luckily we have some who still can speak about that and can help us to understand that the process of becoming the children of God is a process of entering into the cross, trusting that the God whom we name always sort of tentatively, because he is way beyond us, that God will redeem us. So the cross, I think, is an image that touches me deeply.
I think that beyond, or as well as pain, that there's a lot of excitement to talk about these issues. I think the pain would come if we didn't talk about it, and that we didn't have places like this where we can come together and disagree. Look at what Martin Luther did. I mean, look at the pain he must have gone through. I think that it sort of explodes things in my mind, the things you're saying and what Walt's saying, and that's good. You know, I don't feel pain. I feel hunger. I'm eager. I want to see now, what does this mean? You know, I also want to, what was his experience? And I just think that we are fortunate to be able to be in a place where we are open to listen to each other.
That's what discussion is all about.
Yeah.
Makes all the difference.
There is yet more light and truth to be revealed. And this is part of it. The canon probably shouldn't have been closed.
To leave you with some closing images, I quoted Lois Wilson last night. She is a minister in the United Church of Canada. She's a past president of the World Council of Churches and the Canadian Council of Churches. And she talked about reimagining community, about what faith calls us to in community. And she starts out with an apocryphal story. And she says, there's an apocryphal story of the synagogue's rabbi who wanted to do an audiovisual presentation about the lion and the lamb lying down together. So he rented a storefront window in his town, and for a whole week, there was a live lion and a live lamb lying down together in the window. At the end of the week, one of the members of the synagogue asked, "Rabbi, how did you ever do it?" "Oh," he answered, "we've got a large supply of lambs." And what she says is, sometimes the vision fails. Sometimes the vision of world community fails. And she says that with the complicity of the Christian community and of us as women, this vision has failed. Legitimizing wars, accepting things as they are, accepting faith as conformist rather than subversive, regarding creation and the natural world as insignificant. And so she starts with three assumptions about reimagining community. And the first assumption has to do with the fact that faith is about interdependent community. And being at Holden and saying that is such a wonderful thing because we experience that so profoundly here. She says the second assumption about faith has to do with the transformation of things as they are, both personal and societal, and therefore must always include the subject of power. And this is what she says. "It's beyond me how Christians traipse to Handel's Messiah every Christmas and bellow out, 'The valleys shall be raised up, the mountains shall be brought low,' and just go on as if nothing has happened. This is the imagery of the non-human world and the transformation that we can expect." And her third assumption is that community can be reimagined only as those on the periphery and those in the center come together and are set free from their bondage. And there's not enough time now to lay all of that out, but the image of the margins and the center coming together and touching and healing one another as they are both present with Christ is a really powerful one.